Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Knock Knock Williams.
I don't know what Knock Knock's supposed to be a reference to, so hi.
It's a reference to the snoring guy actually knocking on the door as he's coming into the house. So
cool.
Yeah. Also with us is the wonderful and illustrious Amy I. Jane U. Robot from Cakeless Crusaders.
Still the intern, but I'm here.
And intern, that's right. This is a spookity special edition of The Filmlosophers, as we're going to be taking some time to kind of dive deep into the whole idea of what social thrillers are. And if you haven't heard that term, we'll let you know what it is and how it's been reshaping the world of horror. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Spence, give them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can catch us all over the web. Hey, you know what? I get so excited and hyped every time I hear you do the credits. It's like watching somebody grow. You're doing so much better than your first day because you totally bombed. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no,
I'm
just, that's not surprising. I was waiting for it. I know who you are. I know what happens here.
It's true. But no, check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. We got over 230-something episodes, all ranging from different things from Bruce Lee to horror movies to... We even did a whole month on Miyazaki.
Yep.
So that was pretty cool.
And then most of a month on Satoshi-san.
That's right. Minus one episode.
Which, for some reason, there was a movie for that. I don't know.
I'm just saying, you know, hey, somebody had to see Bill and Ted. Somebody did. So.
Oh, yeah, that was right. I did have to see Bill and Ted. It was new.
It was good. I mean, Amy saw it.
I liked it, but they left the door open, and I wanted more. I expected more.
See, it was the ending. Let's talk about Bill and Ted again.
Oh, my gosh.
They left the ending open for space because, you know, they're like, now there is Bill and Ted lady version of Small Children's, and yeah, they left it so much open. There's so much space.
I feel like they could have just done a better job closing it. That's why I wanted to do like an extra credit episode. We now get on round two, Eddie.
We were going to get around to it, okay? Just hold your horses. Well, there's so many other things that we need to talk about, including tonight's episode on social thrillers. If you're not familiar with the term, or you even have been living under a rock for the last, what, 5-6 years? Social thrillers have pretty much come and taken over what is now the mainstay for most horror films. Popularized, obviously, by Jordan Peele. Incredible director, funny comedian, funny comic, but who knew he could throw with the best of them when it comes to horror movies. So this is an opportunity to kind of dive deep into the logic, if you will, the history, the origin, and kind of where it's going. Because honestly, I don't see social thrillers going away anytime soon, nor do I believe that it's going to lessen in terms of its impact in horror movies. I just wanted to hear that drop.
It's a great drop. Like,
it really is. Well, this movie, among many, we'll talk about, of course, but reshaping not only the way people see movies and see horror movies, but also experience certain songs. Like, we were just going through this before the episode, and we were talking about this one, and we were talking about the one that that is associated with the new Candyman trailer, which unfortunately is getting pushed back to 2021.
Say my name.
Takes Destiny's Child.
Well, it's honest, plural. I always had a hard
time
remembering.
It's not Destiny's Child.
No, but it's Destiny's Child's song.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so many apostrophes and S's going on. It's too much.
It's like, hold on, this is too late to be worrying about grammar.
It's the band that's not just Beyonce, even though it kind of was just Beyonce.
Even when they lost their fourth member, nobody talks about, just like in the Dreamgirls. Anyway,
I wanted to
say my name, Candyman. Thankfully, we're not in the dark, and I'm not in a bathroom with
so
a mirror.
If you are unaware, a social thriller, which was the term coined by Jordan Peele himself, is essentially a film genre using elements of suspense and horror to augment instances of oppression in society. Many of these focus on issues of race, class, gender, sexuality, nationhood, even in the dynamic of the emotional aspect, the emotional spectrum of individuals. We were just actually, me and Amy were talking about, I've talked about it with Amy and I talked about it with Spencer, recently watching The Invisible Man.
The new one.
The most recent one, yes. And how that one kind of touches on a couple of emotional traits that we'll dive into in a little bit. But the first thing I kind of want to do, so first off, obviously, if you're listening to this either on or around Halloween, happy Halloween. We hope you're being safe. We hope you are...
following the rules of Halloween, or Little Sam will come and get you.
Yes, very much so.
Happy Samhain. happy Samhain, y'all.
But my first question for you guys here at the table is, have you guys, prior to the big boom, I guess if you want to call it, in the last 5-6 years before Jordan Peele, have you guys ever experienced a social thriller prior to Get Out? I guess is the real honest question.
Well, that's a really hard question to answer because, like, probably when you mentioned the term social thriller, I had never heard of it before.
Yeah.
So I had to look it up, and there is just no standard definition, really, because people were putting, like, guess who's coming to dinner in that category, and I'm like,
I mean, which mind you, they put it in that category, but only for the purpose of, I mean, I think, honestly, it could have turned into something of a horror film, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take, because Jordan Peele went on an interview and said that actually part of his inspiration for Get Out was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Right.
With Sidney Poitier. So I find it fascinating that a simple film like that can inspire the movie that has us all afraid of teacups. You know,
and I like tea. That's the most depressing thing. If I clink on accident, I get scared.
Yeah, you're gonna start triggering people. So prior to that, though, Amy, had you seen anything before Get Out?
Film wise,
anything
no.
In terms of like social commentary pieces? Well, and I ask because
wait. We need to preface with I am probably the most or the least horror watched person. Not only in
horror
this...
watched. Person?
Yes.
As in a person who watched horror?
Has not watched a plethora, a cornucopia, assortment of horror films, because I have a problem where if I'm hearing something, all of my triggers for scares, jump scares and everything are audio based. So like I could watch Halloween without the sounds and be okay. But as soon as you add the music, it gets really bad. So if we're referring to have I seen in the visual medium of horror, no, for social thrillers, but for books, yes.
And we're gonna talk about other mediums in terms of,
but film,
well, and the thing is, Spencer, you were onto something when you mentioned it earlier. Prior to 20, when did Get Out come out? 2014? Oh, 17.
Yeah.
Get Out?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like it's been out a lot longer than that. No. Maybe just because its impact has been that much bigger.
I just double-checked. 17, yes.
But bam.
Well, okay. Prior to 2017, prior to the last like 3-4 years, the film genre didn't go by social thriller. It was just a social commentary film. It was a horror film on social commentary. Going back to things like...
Rosemary's Baby.
Well...
You brought that one up. That's the only reason I know about it.
I mean, that's one, but like the 1968 version of Night of the Living Dead, you know, that was a social commentary piece. That was a horror film. Mm-hmm. Right off the heels of things like the Civil Rights Movement, you have a film that is forcing this house of white people to have to follow this one black person who seems to be able to keep everybody alive. And the dynamic of having a movie where your lead protagonist is black in a time when there were still, in several many places, segregated diners and segregated, pretty sure segregated movie theaters, or even just all black theaters and all white theaters. You know, you have this movie playing, and it's a shock to the system for a lot of people, especially for the people who are in the area of like, wait, do I do that? Or am I one of those types of people? Because if you look at a social thriller, one of the biggest things that it edges out to try to do is it tries to create the awareness for the audience that the real monster, the real thing to fear, is the person sitting in the seat next to you. And that's a really kind of unique instance to kind of be in when it comes to movies, because if you're going to the movie theaters all the time and you're seeing these types of movies, and you know the movie there is meant to make you feel like you can't trust the person you went to the theaters with, that's always a fun.
You go to the movies with Spencer all the time.
Back in the before time.
And
Spencer fears you.
The only time I have ever had any distrust in Spencer was when we went to go see Dora the Explorer. That was it.
He just wanted to watch that last ending sequence and get to the courtyard where there was water and fireworks.
No.
Okay, swipe or no swiping.
But
just real quick, it was an amazing experience to go.
You know what? We're not even gonna talk about it.
And I had a fun time.
You had a fan fun time.
Yeah, fun time.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, I got a F word for you later.
forget about it.
Falafel.
Hey, falafel.
Ah, now I'm hungry. Yeah.
You went down this date. This
look where you brought us.
All right, let's put the train back on the track.
Who's got the map? Open the backpack.
You know, I will pull this podcast
Donde
over.
Está boots.
I will. Oh my gosh, that is the most Karen thing you have said. In the history of all things you've said.
I wanted to do it
said.
As poorly as I could. There was an emphasis.
Well, I feel like that's how Dorothy does it. So we're talking about social
media. Yeah. Talking about like horror movies and movies I plan to not see again. No, it's in the element of kind of seeing movies that you come to find out have some sense of subtext to it. Spencer and I, we've talked at length about certain horror films, certain movies. Now, mind you, real quick, let me make this quick addendum. Yes, a social thriller can fit into the category of several other film genres. Social thriller is a subgenre. So you could have a social thriller in like a crime noir film. You could have a social thriller in drama. You could have a social thriller in everything. It fits in just about everything. Animated? I don't know. But either way.
Watch Ship Down.
No, Zootopia.
Oh.
I just realized. Watership Down?
Sorry.
What is wrong with you?
Distracted.
Watership Down is like the American Grave of the Fireflies. It's horrible. Talk about horror movies. Do you want to see a movie where they talk
about... You already associated it with Grave of the Fireflies. The answer is no.
That's actually... You're right. Good job, Amy. Yes. Grave of the... Watership Down.
I didn't.
You know they did a remake of it too on Netflix.
Watership Down.
Yeah, they did.
Makes no sense. So yes, it does fit within several other genres, film genres. The thing is, it just seems to find a solid foothold within the horror genre and has for some time. I mean, if you go back in time and you look at the 40s and 50s. Looking at some of like the Universal Monster films, those films were some sense of the way a version of a social commentary piece. You know, you take the look of Frankenstein and the way he's dressed, the way he looks, the way his eyes are deadpan, and there's some similarity in the sense of like during the Depression, during the time of the you know, the lack of food in certain areas of the world and things like that, in certain areas of the U.S. And it just, it, there's a similarity there. You know, you get different elements from different films. You move forward through time in a bit, and you're looking at things like, I mean, for God's sakes, Godzilla at the time, even though it's a kaiju film, was considered a horror movie back then. And if anybody has ever seen the original Japanese version, the original is a full-on, like a parable about the dangers that of what the U.S. has been doing with testing atomic weaponry near their shores. So there's a lot if you go through it all, and mind you, we're not going to go through every single thing, but know that, like, social commentary began way before social thriller type films have been around since like the 20s and 30s. I actually remember the first time I ever saw a social thriller had to have been when I saw Metropolis.
I knew which one you were going to say too. I was like, I know.
Metropolis is a movie that's actually a German film.
Did it come after Nosferatu?
Oh, I don't know. I have Nosferatu open. I don't know. Yeah, actually it did.
Hey!
So Nosferatu came out in 1922. Metropolis, however, came out in 1927. The thing is, the reason why I saw Metropolis is, oddly enough, when I was younger, I saw a PBS special about how they were working to restore the film reels that they had, the original film reels they had for Metropolis, because apparently where they were stored were really kind of like dark and damp and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the reels got destroyed. So apparently there was a time like years and years ago where they found a whole new set of reels and were beginning to like splice them together and work and make them, you know, a whole film. So I remember watching all that. And then they were like, oh, and by the way, we're going to showcase this on a PBS special tomorrow night or whatever. I remember watching that special and I was like, man, I mean, it was all in subtitles because why am I drawing blanks tonight?
I don't know. You doing okay over there?
You had enough protein?
No. When there's no words. A silent film. Silent film. I blanked out on silent. I blanked out on silent.
I think we need to call it.
Shush. I blanked out on silent. It was a silent film during the time when, you know, movies were beginning to create the transition into talkies.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a movie that really, really was weird at the time when I first saw it, but the one scene that I always remember, that I always recall, was the scene where they're underground. So if you've never seen Metropolis is essentially this 1927 German film about the people that live and work below the earth and the people who live and frolic above the earth. And the people that work below the earth, huh?
Keep going. I gave him a modern day variation of that so that he could tie it in.
Actually, you know what will help you, Spencer? You remember that episode with the Revenge of the Mutants or in Futurama where Fry becomes like one of the mutants
that lives down in the sewer?
And they revolt against the people up top.
Okay.
That was a parody of Metropolis.
Oh.
So essentially the people down below, they're there to work and toil and make everything work for everybody above. So they decide that they're going to rebel with the help of this school teacher and this son of a CEO, and so blah blah blah. It goes on, but there's a scene in the film that always got to me because it was a scene where these guys, they're literally working this huge machine, and as it's going, the one guy who's in charge of like the steam valves ends up like passing out, like either passing away or something, and all the meters like peek out, and there's a huge explosion, and this guy is watching it, and they literally just come out, take the bodies, leave, and new people come out and they continue working. But there's a whole scene where like they're feeding the bodies in a hallucination of his. They're feeding the bodies to this like owl like beast because all they're doing is just working and toiling and, you know, so forth. So, but that scene, it always stuck with me. And mind you, there's a whole mindset of like, you know, the those that go without and the choice of, you know, consumerism and the way people live and exuberance and not remembering your fellow man kind of thing. There's a whole subtext to it. But I say all that to say, coming to where we are now, it's become more and more available. Like if you look and jump onto Vudu or Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, you could literally like close your eyes, point a finger, and put your finger right on a social thriller nowadays. Because they seem like they're coming more and more frequently. You have directors who are coming out. We had mentioned a little bit ago Nia DaCosta's Candyman, which is actually got pushed back and is moving to 2021. But then you had the great efforts of Jordan Peele with Get Out and then Us, which the song you heard a little bit ago is from Us. But the idea of what a social thriller does tends to vary on several different people and really does, you know, change, you know, a lot of different mindsets, which is what it sets out to do. But I wanted to throw this to you guys. Has there ever been a social thriller for you guys in terms of film? We'll start with film, and then I know Amy's got some other ones. And I know, Spencer, you were talking about you may have other options as well outside of just film. Yeah.
Mine can tie back in because most of them have actually been made into film or into television shows or something along the line. So they're easily accessible if you don't want to read the books, except for some of the comic books.
Well, I'm going to start with Spencer. So Spencer, because of the fact actually that you were the one who you had mentioned Get Out as one of your favorite films from 2017, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
We did an episode where you had mentioned Get Out was on one of your lists.
Yeah.
And for good reason, mind you. But what are some of the ones that stand out to you in terms of social thrillers and why? Well, you don't got to go through all of them, but
no, like, because really to only stand out like really well for me, because I haven't seen terribly many that I would qualify as them, or maybe I don't properly categorize them as, because you know I have a problem with categorizing.
You do. Things. You do. That you do.
So Get Out is one of them, and talked at length how much I loved that movie.
Which is a great movie.
Yeah.
I mean, Jordan Peele's like, really...
I think it was just like... Plus, this 2017, that was his first time like in the director's chair. So it was shocking on multiple levels.
I remember we talked about it when they announced it, you and I, and I was like, the first thing I thought was, all right, well, he's making a comedic horror movie. It's like another scary movie type film.
Yeah.
But... Yeah,
yeah, that would have actually not have been surprising if it was like a scary movie. Like, I guess I kind of expected that a little bit.
Yeah, same here.
But yeah, not what we got. So I think just like the shock of what, like, you know, it was versus what I thought going into it was kind of what helped like cement it really well for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is Sorry to Bother You for just how
my God
off the wall. Okay.
Like, he actually brought this up because we were having a conversation earlier about like different films that I should be aware of. And he was like, have you seen Sorry to Bother You? And I was like, no. And he gave me like a little tiny premise, and then he got distracted and did something else. So I never got the full spiel of it. So tell me.
Oh my gosh. Sorry. There's multiple things going on.
There are so many things
in Sorry to Bother You, because like, even like, I thought it was going to be a commentary in one direction, and it kind of is, but it kind of subverts into a different direction, because Sorry to Bother You is about this guy, I can't even remember what his name is in the movie, but it's played by Boots Riley, and he is poor, living in like
You're talking about Lakeith Stanfield?
Oh yeah.
Boots Riley is the
director.
Yeah, he's the director.
I don't know why I just mixed up their names.
it happens.
He's this poor guy. He lives in like his uncle's garage, which just has a great reveal because it doesn't look like a garage, and then all of a sudden the door goes up.
That's kind of like, cool and weird though.
Yeah. No, actually that's really how the movie is. It's cool and kind of really weird throughout the most of it. He ends up getting like this telemarketing job where he is basically selling people, because it's for this business called Worry Free, which also feels like it's kind of just a stand-in for Amazon and Amazon-like type corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And so Long story short, he just starts making his way up the ladder, but then, like...
Well, he starts making his way up the ladder because Danny Glover tells him that he needs to start using his white voice more.
Yeah.
And Lakeith Stanfield doesn't get it at first, which his name is Cassius.
Oh, yeah.
Cassius doesn't get it at first, and then he hears Danny Glover do it, and Danny Glover has this... What was it? Whose voice was it?
I don't know. I just remember Cash's voice was...
David Cross.
Yeah, from Arrested Development.
So no way. Yeah.
So Cassius learns to tap into his white voice and mm-hmm. then starts getting...
Yeah, he starts getting, like, promoted in the business and starts, like, going into, like, you know, the corporate elevator and up... like to the upper levels, and while that's happening, his old friends in like the lower levels are like doing protests and stuff, and then just being treated like animals, really, by the police, and so, like, oh gosh, and then I forgot about how this movie makes a turn. I'm not going to tell you about that part because
you need to watch it.
Yeah, you have to watch it because you're all of a sudden like, wait, what's happening?
Yeah, because this movie does a full like 180 on you when you're in the middle of watching it and you're like,
yeah,
wait, what's what's happening?
Like, yeah,
that, like, that's how it really gets you. But it's such a unique film because of the fact that Spencer hits it right on the head. Like, there are so many pieces of subtext throughout the film. Like, Detroit, who is Tessa Thompson's character, everything that she's doing as well, there's subtext to what she's doing. And how she's like exploiting herself for her art, and then like the wishy-washiness of her, and then you got like you were saying with the actual company, and then Cassius's whole journey, and then the discovery of what's going on, and the fights in the streets. There's a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. But I watched this movie on recommendation of Spencer. This movie is it'll catch you off guard. I'm glad that I saw it the one time because I have really no intention of seeing it again. Because this movie just kind of grabs you by the holy word and and really just kind of takes you for a stroll down Crackhead Lane, and you know, because you don't know what is happening, and it's instantaneous. Like, you already think the premise of the film is ridiculous enough, and then it's like, and then the video that they show, the instructional, the promotional video for the presentation of their new product, that was really awkward. So
in other words, I need to see this.
But not in the company of any children.
Yes, yeah, do not.
No. man, yeah, I thought I had forgotten about that movie. Thanks a lot.
No, like, because, like, yeah, you're right. It's kind of crazy, and it's not going to be a movie I watch every year.
No.
But, like, well, for me, I'll come back to it every, like, so often when I get, like, that itch for certain movies. But it's also an insane, insane movie.
Yeah. Well, in insanity aside... Like, the subtext to this film is so on the nose. Yeah. Like, there's so much to glean from it. I find it hilarious that Boots Riley was on Twitter one time, and he was talking about this or whatever, and someone actually tweeted back and said, hey, Boots, you should really, you know, focus on real woke films and totally, like, you know, watch those so you can get an idea of how to make a proper, you know, film like that or whatever. And he goes, I would recommend Sorry to Bother You.
What?
He just recommended his own film.
And I believe Boots Riley was like, oh, okay, I'll check it out. Like, just super passive. I'm like, that's a man who's, yeah.
That's very nice because he could have flamed him mm-hmm. so hard.
Yep. Yeah, that movie's got so many things going on with it. Even where you think it's going to be like a little preachy, it knows that it's trying to be preachy, and it plays it off as silly. Like the one where at the very beginning when Cassius is talking to... well, at the time, you just know him as the landlord, Terry Crews. He goes, and it's people like you that keep us down. Blah, blah, blah. He's like, people who've got, you know, got to work and earn money for the family. It's like, family, brother, you're my nephew, or I'm your uncle, or something like that. It's like, oh, like it knows that it's being silly at that point in time, and it just, there's no point to create the obviousness of there. But yeah, that's an intense film. What about you, Amy? Have you ever had, what are some of the most recent or even most notable experiences with social thrillers, and kind of why?
So film wise, then, and I don't know if I said it on the Kipples Crusaders on one of our episodes, that I'd committed to watching horror movies for October, and I got through three that I haven't seen before. So I'd never seen The Shining, mind you, though I knew all of like the points or something like that. And then I saw Dr. Sleep just this last Sunday night. And so in those, I was kind of trying to figure out, they're not technically social thrillers. They do have messages, like Dr. Sleep is more of recovery, versus in Shining, there's addiction. Get Out scared the snot out of me. It was not a completely odd experience, but watching it and then just being where I was at the drive-in. It was weird when I saw it. I watched it at the drive-in, and then when it came out, I went home and watched it again sitting in my house, and it was a lot creepier in my house than in the drive-in, which is weird. So I saw that, and then when it comes more to social commentary thrillers, it's television and book related for me. Mm-hmm. So specifically, it has an adaptation, but Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
Which was published in, I believe it was 1985. Yeah, 85. It's no longer the question of could it happen, it's when it happens. And that creates such a space for where these, a lot of the dystopian novels that have become movies or become thrillers, not necessarily horror, like Minority Report by Philip K. Dick, became a movie. And that was supposed to kind of put in a little, give you a little heads up on that the authority or the freedom that we give the police or the government to almost not even guess, just go, oh, in the next 24 hours, yeah, you're going to commit a crime, we're going to arrest you preemptively. Which is, you guys have seen the Minority Report, so I don't have to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then you've got like The Giver, The Giver, which everyone's is a book from 1993, and I read it as a kid, and I'm like, I hate this.
I hated that book.
Thank you. And I'm just like, gosh. And you liked it, didn't you?
The book?
Yes, Lois Lowry's The Giver. Okay, thank gosh.
No. Oh, that book annoyed me so much.
Yeah, I read it in like fifth grade, and I was like, I don't ever want to read this book again.
Yeah,
I just wasn't a fan of it. I didn't like the whole premise of it, and so when the movie came out, I was just like, nope.
Oh yeah, I forgot the movie existed.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Bridges and a couple other folks.
Well, and my biggest thing was a lot of the dystopian books, and some even the dystopian sci-fi books, which you can look at Blade Runner, which is technically considered a thriller, but not really a
well, and
horror.
even a social commentary piece, yeah, as well. I mean, you look at, so if you're looking at Philip K. Dick, Philip K. Dick has done a lot of different works that have been adapted to the big screen.
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Most recently,
Logan's Run. He also did Logan's Run, but that, oh no, that's not him.
No,
that's Minority Report. That's Nolan did Logan's Run.
But if you're looking at things like that, like A Scanner Darkly is his, which is his total social commentary piece on the nature of drugs created by the government to control the people in populaces, which, I mean, you take anybody, any conspiracy theory about how the government created certain drugs and released them to the U.S., certain, you know, low-income areas to create a need for more police reform and blah, 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 i.e. like the Reagan era. There's a whole debacle behind that whole thing. Philip K. Dick, though, did more for what is now known as the social thriller literary pieces adapted into film,
mm-hmm,
way before anybody realized that's what he was doing. And even after the fact, after the movies were being done, it was still something that people were questioning and deciphering. So,
yeah.
Looks like you're going to say something.
No.
Well, I could also bring up 1985, which came out in 1978.
Wasn't 1985 done by...
By Bookwise, and I wrote it down, Anthony Burgess in 1978.
What's 1985?
Ooh.
Go ahead.
So it is a movie, but the book... No, George Orwell wrote 1985.
That's what I was going to say.
84, right?
1984.
Why did I say 85? 85 is the dystopian version over the top. Okay, so George Orwell, 1984.
Right.
So that one. That's another, like, a lot of dystopian books, especially moving in from the late 19th to the 20th and 21st century, have a focus or the what-if plausibility that now that we are so many years past, it has actually not just become a could or a cautious tale. It's a warning. This will happen.
Well, and not even that, more so. Like, so 1984 is essentially a dystopic film. It takes place in a city called Oceania.
He's read 1984.
No, I haven't.
1984?
No.
Oh, go. Sorry.
That's why I was explaining it, because he was asking.
My bad.
And so essentially the society has gotten so much into like a police state that the government has what's called Big Brother watching, where that's the term Big Brother comes from. And so everybody is being watched, and you know, it's similar in the facet of Equilibrium. Did you ever see that movie Equilibrium?
Ooh, I've seen that one.
With Christian Bale and Tay Diggs, and
he's got the slick back hair and the really long robe.
Really,
and
long time ago.
That one's in similar vein of that, like how everybody's being controlled by Big Brother and so forth. And it's another kind of look at the time when it was first created, at what the future could be if things weren't checked, you know, if things were left to go unchecked. Whereas right now, if you look at where everybody is, I mean, not only is it a cautionary tale, but it's kind of a forewarning of the direction where we're going, you know, today, with police states and the kind of protests that are happening and what is meeting those protests in terms of military, police in you know, using excess force. It definitely saw things down the way. And George Orwell is a great writer. George Orwell is a fantastic writer, and this is one of those elements where it definitely tells the cautionary tale of things that could be kind of like, you know, the ghost of Christmas to come kind of thing.
So for me, it really comes down to a lot of, because I didn't do a lot of horror movies when I was younger. I had one bad spell and I was like, okay, no more, I'm going, bye bye. literally, but so books were much more easily accessible for me, and then seeing how many of them have turned into film or have turned into television, where The Handmaid's Tale won how many Emmys? Like, it was made exclusively for Hulu.
For Hulu, yeah.
And it blew up. And people are like, oh my gosh, this could never happen. And slowly it's become to the point that when Margaret Atwood wrote it in 1985, the entire concept is that there was essentially another civil war. And this time, the part of the states... essentially succeeded from the Union. So there's a free section and then there's another section. And it started slowly oppressing women, because there was a virus that made some women infertile. And so the ones that became infertile, the ones that were able to still have children, they were highly prized and highly favored. But so they stacked the entire concept about women being nothing more than baby makers, like produce children or be sex slaves. And it's this, it's conforming, and it's brutally real, and not just the fact of that there's a virus that could make everybody sterile, or at least women sterile. Didn't apparently hurt the men. Go figure. But that there are these women who their names are taken from them. They are given a name that is, that the handmaiden is tied to whoever their current master is. And you can't hear my air quotes, but there's air quotes. And so we're following a woman called Offred, which it's actually of Fred is, she is the handmaiden of Fred. So they call her Offred. And she has been brought in to this guy that's in the government, and it's got this, they're essentially religious zealots, and he's part of the government. His wife cannot bear children. Her name is Sarah. And so this entire thing, literally, Offred is here to lay in place of his wife for him to create life. And it is like one of the most awkward scenes. It's like, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, and there's no pleasure supposed to be taken from it. It's essentially, it's an assault on women. Mm-hmm. And it is becoming more and more equivalent every day that something like that could happen. It's why also, like, with, I have a cornucopia of comic books that I can talk about where women are being oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, one of them is Bitch Planet. And that came out in started in 2014. It went to 2017 by Kelly Sue DeConnick. And the entire concept of that one is that when it was a 10 issue limited run, you can read it, 2 volumes, you got it, it's okay, cool. That the world has been taken over by somebody called Josephson. He's the president, but now he's a global president. And the globe is run by a community of the Fathers. No joke, they're called the Fathers. And all women are supposed to be compliant, which means dressing the appropriate way, you don't talk back. It is a system entirely of subservience. And if you are found non-compliant, your spouse, your master, whatever they want to call them, turns you over to the government and says she's non-compliant. They blast you off into a spaceship and send you to a planet that's, I remember it's like, the acronym is ACO. I don't remember exactly what the name is, but everybody refers to it as Bitch Planet. So it is an all-female prison planet, and the women that are there are forced to fight each other, like battle royale to the death, on televised for everybody back on Earth, as a warning to the women that are still there, but also as entertainment for the men. And so these are women, you follow 4 of them, and some of them, it's, they're different, or they took partners that were not acceptable to the Fathers, and they've become non-compliant. And so it's a exploitation film as well as a prison film, and it's like, it's a lot, but it's another one that it's every day the expectation of a woman is to be a certain way, and if the patriarchy doesn't like you, suddenly you are a nasty, nasty woman, and everything goes to bring you down. Also, I have one about, you know, women or young girls menstruating, and suddenly the government decides to control their bodies, inject them with hormones, which Spencer was reading a little bit of it before.
Yeah, it was actually really interesting. I already had questions about, like, you know, logistics of this, but I actually liked what I read so far.
Yeah, and that's Man Eaters by Chelsea Kane. It went to, I believe, 2 volumes. It was 2018. And the entire concept, like I said, which Eddie refers to the movie Ginger Snaps.
Mm-hmm.
But these young girls, essentially, they get it's like a toxio something that comes basically from cats. And it only affects girls. And when they menstruate, they become giant feral cats and will murder people. So the government has decided that all the boys need to take a special medication, and all the girls need to get injected and wear collars. And if they start menstruating, then they have problems, and they need to be sent essentially to jail to be controlled so that they will stop menstruating and protect the men in their community. And I think Bleeding Cool did an entire article on Man Eaters and how it violates the comic book code of 1954 just for the first issue. And it was kind of hilarious.
What's that?
The comic book code?
Oh, is that little star that's on the... Okay, okay.
So, the comic book code of 1950... Well, of the 1950s, but 1954 specifically, is a running list of things that you are not allowed to do in comic books. And so one of the very first ones is you are not allowed to create fear or disrespect to the government or the police. And you are not allowed to show any opposition to them as well. And so the main character in the book, Maud, her dad's a divorced cop. And so it paints this situation at the end of, spoiler, at the end of issue one, she gets her period and she's freaked out. And so now you know. Oh, and it's also one that's, it's, you are not allowed to encourage or perpetrate crimes to be committed, like in your comic book. And you know that now that she's got her period, she's going to turn into a giant cat. She's going to murder people. And that's going to put her in a direct line of confrontation with her father, who is a cop. So, like, it goes down an entire running list of an... Are you looking it up over there?
I'm listening to you.
Oh, no. I was just wondering. Because I was like, if you want to read some more off, because I only remember the ones about, you know, showing the government or police in a bad light or encouraging crime.
Can't even listen and multitask. I'm over here trying to produce, and this one's over here about to bite my head off. Are you about to turn into a cat?
No, and if you're asking if I'm menstruating,
no,
I'm
I don't
not.
Need to know. No, that's not information.
You just walked right into that. Well, see, that just makes me feel like you weren't listening.
I was listening.
Well, I knew not to answer that question.
Because, see, Spencer on the win. I mean, and those are the ones that are specifically, and I didn't even talk about Unnatural, which comes from Mirka Adolfo, which started, she's an Italian writer. And it started in 2018. It's a 12 limited issue. It came, or yeah, 12 issue limited, came actually translated to Image. And the entire concept is you're following a pig named, let me put it the nicer way, it's Adult Zootopia. But what happens is that only your species can mate with your other species. You're not allowed to love anybody outside your species. So we're following a character. Her name's Leslie. She's a pig, very cute pig. She is approaching 21. The government says she has to be partnered and mated with another pig by this time. And if she hasn't, and she's not betrothed or anything else, they will sign her up, find her a mate, and make her get married for the safety of all. But mind you, there's this underground running line of, like, her best friend's a goat, and he's in love with, I think he's in love with, like, a sheep or something like that. And then she's actually attracted to a wolf. And then there's this whole other running
thing.
Well,
she's attracted to a wolf that's been kind of haunting her dreams, so to speak. Like, she dreams of the wolf.
He has them if you want to read them, because I made him. I'm like, take my comic book, sir. Take my comic book.
It's definitely kind of the whole recognizing you can marry who you choose and fall in love. You can't help who you fall in love with. And if you choose to fall in love with someone unconventional,
The government shouldn't be coming in and brainwashing you and murdering the people that you love or disfiguring you to make you comply.
Yeah. The government has no say in who you love, ultimately.
Yeah.
Ta-da!
Yeah. And those are all really great issues. And I'm pretty sure Amy can reiterate all those as we go to the tail end of the episode later. That way we make sure we have everything top of mind as we close out.
Yeah.
But
I have notes.
She's got notes.
And a brain.
Okay. I was thinking about this question, and I'm like, so yes, I think it's already been stated. I watch a lot of movies. Okay, it's understated. I watch a lot of movies, and in terms of, like, horror films, I think that's predominantly most of what I watch. And so, like I said, when I saw Metropolis, and mind you, at the time, I didn't know what the full subcontext was when I first saw it, but I remember seeing it, and I remember it having this huge impact on my life. What?
I forgot Parasite.
The movie?
Yes.
Are you going to talk about it?
No, but I'm putting it out there because you reminded me. Oh my God. So you can talk about Parasite because it's your turn. But I was remembering when you were asking about it, and I was like, oh, I saw Get Out, and then I saw Parasite, and it ties back to Metropolis. But, yeah, go.
How does it tie? What? Okay, never mind. And oddly enough, I was actually going to talk about Parasite.
So it worked out.
Shush. So, yes, there are tons of movies I could pull from, anything from 1970s Invasion of the Body Snatchers to even 1989? Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, which I've talked to Spence about it.
Scream Queen.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, looks like 85. Man, I was off.
Ooh.
I was way off.
How is this possible?
It happens. 1985's Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, which, mind you, is supremely underappreciated. In the fact that it's not really a Freddy movie. and there's a whole unique conversation that goes with it. Mind you, it's not the one I want to talk about, but it is the one I want to mention, that if you haven't had a chance to see the movie and then check out this really awesome documentary called Scream Queens, talking about the quote-unquote first male Scream Queen, it's a great movie. And the whole idea with what they did with that movie and the message that it gives off, it's pretty empowering and pretty wonderful. And if you're somebody who at any point in time is struggling with self-identity and, you know, whether or not who you choose to love, kind of talking about with in line with Unnatural, this movie, if you're a fan of horror movies, is definitely one that's kind of in that arena. But no, I kind of wanted to jump forward to actually a more recent film that I just saw, and that was the movie that actually I originally pushed off to see because I thought the trailer gave away too much when I first saw it, and that was 2020's The Invisible Man. Now, oddly enough, you were mentioning, Amy, Handmaid's Tale. The woman who is the lead actress in Handmaid's Tale,
she's Offred.
She is actually also the lead actress in The Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And so if you've seen this trailer, the first thing that usually immediately comes to mind is, what's the point in watching it? Because it looks like it gives everything away. However, with that in mind, I literally saw the movie, saw the trailer in theaters with Spencer, turned to Spencer and said, I don't want to see that movie. That movie literally already told me everything about it.
Yeah, and I was kind of on the same because the trailer just didn't make it look like there was anything left to see.
No, exactly. And unfortunately, this is a clear... example of the people who cut and create the trailers doing a disservice to the film itself, because I ended up gathering the courage and mustering my boredom and was like, you know what? It's on HBO Max.
Okay, you click play on a movie. You didn't really do terribly much.
I did do terribly much.
For him?
I had to fight with HBO Max. Do you know that? It took me forever to get HBO Max to actually play the audio. I did.
He fought with himself because he's like, I have to admit that I was wrong. I have to put my pride on the line.
Okay, no,
try to watch this.
I feel like that's not admitting you're wrong, because like, I saw that trailer. It was bad.
The trailer was really bad.
It really was.
No, it really is. No, honestly, there's this trailer for this movie. I can assure you, if the actual filmmakers went and created the trailer for this movie, it would have been 100 times better than what that trailer did.
You mean we could have put in the trailer for Enough in its place, and it would have done a better chance at showing the...
No, there's no Jennifer Lopez in this one.
But we could try.
No, like not J-Lo. Even close.
Her hair was really nice in that movie.
Self-defense is not murder.
It's not.
Okay, we're not talking about killing people. But
are we? It was mostly horror.
You know what? I'm going to hide the knives from both y'all.
Okay? We have knives? There's knives?
Yeah. No. Stay in your seat.
Knives out.
So, this movie, surprisingly, I decided to watch it the other day in preparation for this, because I had heard a couple people mention this movie.
Out of boredom.
This movie was apparently had some social commentary to it. So, I was like, eh. So, I started the movie and wasn't really paying attention. I'm like, all right, I'll just put it on my, I watched it because it's not in, you know, it's showed fully watched in my HBO Max. Like,
are people checking your HBO Max for if you actually watch
it? I would go back and check it and be like,
Okay, but you know how much you paid attention.
Not enough, apparently, at first.
No, the first time it was on, I wasn't paying attention fully in the beginning.
Right.
And so I'm watching it, and I'm playing games on my phone, and I'm, you know, trying to catch some Pokemon, and I'm sitting there, and then stuff's happening. I'm like, wait, what? What's happening? And so I have to get the remote control, rewind it, go back to here. I'm like, oh, okay, that was pretty clever. And so I let the film continue, and I go back to playing Pokemon or whatever's on my phone. And then something else happens and I'm freaked out. I'm like, what the heck was that? and I go and I watch and it doesn't make sense. I'm like, all right, rewind it again. So I'm like, maybe I should pay attention.
Yeah.
So I ultimately restarted the film, put my phone down, and I started watching the movie. Lo and behold, this movie is actually really good. Because of the fact that, yes, it is another remake of a movie that has been remade several times by now. And the pop is sitting on the table as we speak for The Invisible Man. However, this iteration takes it kind of to the next level. Because essentially you have this woman who is in a relationship that is very controlling. The boyfriend not only is verbally abusive, but also physically and emotionally abusive to her. It's very aware as she's trying to, in the middle of the night at like 3 a.m, she is trying to escape from the house so that way she can leave him. And she apparently tries to drug him. It's indicated that she tries to drug him before so that he can make sure he's asleep. And the whole scene of like her trying to quietly tiptoe and not try to wake him and see the, like the genuine fear on this actress's face. And it's like, oh my God, are we going to talk about relationships in this movie? Cause I don't know if I was prepared for that. And I start watching it and I'm like, oh my God, this guy is so toxic. And then, you know, not really a spoiler, but the guy ends up quote unquote killing himself and leaves his whole estate to the girl, which her name is Cecilia. He leaves his whole estate to her as long as obviously she sticks within the parameters of she doesn't get arrested for anything and she's of sound mind. And slowly things start happening that she can't explain. And everybody tries to tell her like, oh, it's actually, you know what? He's gone. So whatever you're experiencing, you're probably just making it up in your head. And I'm like, oh my God, this movie is about toxic masculinity. This is about gaslighting to the fullest. And you watch this movie and you're like, this movie does a really good job of recognizing like what toxic relationships look like and how it affects the people that you care about and how those types of individuals that are toxic in the relationship not only make you toxic because you're around them, but it makes the people that you're around sick from the toxicity of what's going on. And it escalates. Like this movie, I actually would recommend this movie to people now. Like before I would have been like, whatever. But like I saw this movie and immediately my brain is like, yeah, this movie has a really solid message. And mind you, we don't really see a lot of the situations where you have women be the, aside from Handmaid's Tale. Aside from like things like that, where it really does, we don't have enough of those. Where it really gives the opportunity to showcase how women are sometimes treated as the inferior species of humanity. And it's insane how this type of film really does hit that on the head in terms of recognizing, hey, this is a real thing. This happens. And this is something that somebody you may know is experiencing.
Well, I was going to even bring up that the entire term gaslighting comes from a movie in 1944 with Ingrid Bergman and Charles, I guess it's Boyer, called Gaslight. And so it's literally a noir thriller where Ingrid Bergman's character is sent to Italy after the death of her famous aunt. She's inherited this estate. While she's there, she meets Charles Boyer. I'll never pronounce the name right. She meets him. They fall in love. They get married. They go back to London. And suddenly she starts seeing things are going missing. She's hearing footsteps in the middle of the night. And the lamps, because they were lit by gas, are dimming unexpectedly without anybody touching it. And so she is like asking him, hey, these things are going on. I know I'm not crazy. I know I haven't done this. And he's slowly eating away at her confidence and her sanity in an attempt for her to kill herself or get put into an asylum so that he can gain her inheritance. So the entire concept, which we see very prevalently nowadays, and we're able to recognize it a lot more, regardless of if it's just toxic masculinity, but toxic relationships as a whole, we're able to recognize it thanks to a film.
Oh, wow. There you go. I didn't even know that, to be honest with you. But
laying down some truth here.
Shazam!
Nothing like Google to help you get the information.
Nothing like a book about gaslighting to actually bring up the movie and then go do research yeah, on it.
It's actually true.
Thank you, The Gaslighting Effect.
You're welcome.
No, I'm just kidding. You're not the author.
Okay.
You're not the author. And that was awkward. That was awkward.
You're welcome. No.
Oh, no, that's really toxic, too. Keep talking.
No, and that's actually a really great book. I actually read it not too long ago, and because it was recommended to me in the ability to recognize when it's happening within any kind of relationship, whether if it's friendships or romantic relationships or professional relationships, it really does kind of lay it all out there like a really well, you know, placed plan to explain the purpose of, or not really the purpose, but like what it looks like when, you know, when it is happening, and
how to recognize it and how to move forward. Because when it comes down to it, there are a lot of people, and it's not even just in relationships, it's almost in general, there are people who find that gaslighting as a form of manipulation and control, regardless of sex, is the way to ensure their happiness or that they get what they want in the end, which is scary to begin with.
Which is unique in this film, because one of the things that the guy had wanted with his girlfriend, with Cecilia, was he wanted to start a family. So she purposefully went on birth control to make sure that didn't happen. However, she later learns that she was actually pregnant, and that apparently the boyfriend knew that she decided to take those and was switching out those pills with other things to ensure that they get pregnant.
Yeah, no.
And mind you, this is all like the performance of, you know, what is her name? Elizabeth Moss. The performance of Elizabeth Moss is like phenomenal in this movie, because it's like you can see what you see, Amy, what you saw in like The Shining.
Shelley Duvall's was earnest. There was no faking the problem, not even the problems, but the side effects of abuse are plain on her face. And you can see the verbal abuse, and you can see the emotional abuse, even with just interacting with Jack Nicholson in the sequence where she's backing up the stairs with the bat swinging. You see she's torn between those spaces of like she wants to turn around and run away, but she can't. And she's trying to face it. Or when she initially brings in his breakfast, like at the very beginning, when they're the first month in, where she just literally rolls it in. She's like, good morning. And she's trying to make it nice. And she's trying to like keep him happy. And even there, you see all of the little tiny telltale marks of abuse that are not acted, that are actually present. And that made it so difficult to watch that film, because I'm like, I see that you're abused, woman. This is not okay.
Well, and that's part of the because of the fact I don't know. I believe Shelley Duvall is still alive. I'm not too sure.
I thought she was. I will check.
But that's kind of where that fine line is at with most performances, especially when it's in the arena of a Stanley Kubrick film.
She's still alive.
Okay, she's still alive.
Okay. Don't scare me.
Everybody breathe a sigh of relief.
Know when 2020 is coming for people.
She's 71. She's still alive. We're doing good.
What'd you say, Smith?
So you never know when 2020 is coming for people.
That's so messed up. It's so true. And I'm so mad at you, but I appreciate you so much.
Because all in all, I mean, Shelley Duvall was an excellent actress. How much of it was acting versus how much of it was really her, with the knowledge of knowing what happened behind the scenes, it's really hard, because you never want to rob anybody of a good job, you know, especially when it comes to things like that. And I'm not saying it didn't have an effect on her mind, but what I'm saying is I also don't know everything, you know, But I'm pretty sure it, well, I know for sure, for a fact, it messed her up really bad. But with that kind of conversation and with in terms of Shelley Duvall, Elizabeth Moss in this film is phenomenal in this movie. She is, you see that progression of just like the bags under her eyes, the twitchy, you know, looking around and the concern of where she is and being aware at all times and, you know, recognizing like there is no safety if he is still around, if he is not, you know, there's just so many elements to this movie that really took me by surprise in an effort to kind of see how, I mean, obviously with without any limits, how far someone who is a who has a toxic personality, you know, in a relationship, what that looks like. What does a narcissist look like within the dynamic of a relationship? And it's this film really does, man, do wonders to the psyche. Like, there's a ton of Chads out there that really need to see this movie. I don't use
I had to check on that when I was like, wait, Chad or like
no
Kyles? Are you talking Kyles?
Kyles and Chads.
Okay, so not the Chad that the nice.
No.
I had to check. I just again, make sure.
We love you, Chad, who used to be on this podcast.
We do. This is already the second time we've had to do this.
I'm just making sure, but that's there's a lot of. Like, oh my gosh, Elizabeth Moss in Handmaid's Tale, she gets to points where she's fighting in defiance through the TV show to escape. And you see places where it is fear, like she's hyper paranoid, or she understands that if her character in Handmaid's Tale does not get pregnant, that she will be subjected to literally cattle prods, like with the other women who are in the same position as her. Because they have not produced a child yet. Like, it's bonkers.
Yeah. Well, and kind of transitioning from that perspective of, you know, of toxic masculinity to kind of societal toxicity as well. Talking about 2019's Parasite, since you brought it up.
I really like that movie. And there's a couple of my favorite Korean actors in it, including the guy that ends up playing the rich guy, which... It happens that he just ended up playing the rich guy, but he's a really great actor, and I appreciate everything that's coming out of Korea right now.
Well, Bong Joon-ho has done incredible works prior to this. I mean,
Train to Busan.
He did Train to Busan. He did The Host. He did Okja. You know, he did Snowpiercer.
I was like, yeah, why didn't I bring up Snowpiercer?
What did you say before? What was your suggestion?
I said Parasite, Train to Busan, and
then, Train to Busan, yeah.
Yeah, and then Snowpiercer was the other one where I was like, ooh, that's another dystopian, like, cray-crayness right there.
Wait, he didn't do Train to Busan.
Who did Train to Busan then?
Now we gotta check.
Because they always recommend when I finished watching Parasite, and hey, I was just like...
They're not all the same person.
No, I'm saying... Sang-ho-yeon? I'm saying the algorithm recommended Train to Busan right after Parasite, and I was like...
He didn't direct it.
Okay, cool. So, my friend.
But he did do, like I said, he did Parasite, he did Okja, he did Snowpiercer.
Mother. That's another one.
Well, I haven't seen that one.
Neither have I, but again, it came up on my, hey, do you liked Parasite? You should watch this. And I was like...
And then he did The Host. And then recently, which I haven't had a chance to see... but it has been popping up and is showcasing as like a special film that they're re-releasing, Memories of a Murder. Apparently that's one of his first films back in 2003. So I'm actually anxious to see that because he does have some of the same actors and actresses that he has throughout most of his films. But Parasite is essentially about this lower class family that tries to make ends meet by... You know, whatever means whatever, and they essentially latch themselves onto this wealthy family little by little, incorporating themselves into their everyday life, whether if it's as a tutor, a art teacher, a housemaid, or a driver. They inundate themselves amongst this family to pretty much be the necessity for them, so they can have money on the regular. Little by little, their relationship is kind of getting a little cloudy. They find, you know, that the son is having feelings for the girl, and things start happening, and then it kind of takes a really big twist at the middle there, at the beginning of the third act, where you're like, oh, what? almost, but not quite on the same level as Sorry to Bother You, but still takes a little bit of a left turn. This movie really does a lot of things contextually below the surface when it comes to imagery as well as story elements. The way this movie ends is heartbreaking because you ultimately realize, like, you come to the realization that the dream that the boy is having will never come to pass, no matter what. And it's the state of the world for them in Korea, as well as all over the place. You know, you have the different classes of people. You have the lower class people, the middle class, and so forth. And there's just this sense of separation. Wait, excuse me.
Bless you.
This sense of separation when it comes to people and those that have and those that have not. This movie just speaks on so many different levels in terms of the recognition of how much those that have tend to take for granted as opposed to those that have not. And there's just so much subcontext to this movie. It was one of my favorite films from 2019. I mean, honestly, this was another one where I wasn't too sure. I had seen The Host. I liked, you know, horror movies. So The Host is one of those movies about a creature that is terrorizing that city. And looking at the trailer for Parasite, I kind of thought it was more of like a drama. But this movie is straight up, you know, it's intense. And it really does change the face of how you view, you know, certain families that come in or certain people that come in to help take care of other people. Especially if you don't vet them properly. But what did you think about it, Spence? Because I know we actually recorded that episode where we reviewed Parasite at your house.
Oh yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, no, I loved Parasite. Like, it was just not what I was expecting from a movie. Gosh, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I just remember enjoying it a lot. Yeah, that ending though, that really does make me sad. Because, like, at first I was like, I don't understand. Did he get out? Did he not get out? And then I was like, oh. And then kind of just left with the reality of the situation. I don't know, like, it's weird because it feels like it's, like, really identifiable but also not.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I've never worked for a family that was that rich before and then somehow snuck my family in. But at the same time, I also feel like, you know, I guess I just have life experience of being that poor, so I can understand that, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
level of, like, you know, we need to do this to survive type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good movie. I really enjoyed it.
Which, by the way, if you haven't checked it out, that is lesson 213 on our episode list. So we talked about that.
It sounds like it's not even that long ago.
No, it isn't. Like, what, at least 20, 30, 25 episodes away. So, but I mean, that kind of, this conversation kind of does bring around to the ultimate question that I have for you guys. And mind you, I have my own opinions, but I kind of want to know your guys' thoughts as well. Because as movies go forward and you have people who are creating for the genre, you also do get to a point, much like with what we're getting with some of the superhero films and so forth, you kind of hit a saturation point.
Mm.
You know, it goes with anything. You hit a point where there's just so many of these types of movies being thrown out into the theaters that you're like, you know, I guess that could be a good film. But you're like, you're not as eager to go see it because of the fact that there are so many of those coming out. Case in point, recently there was the release of Janelle Monáe's horror film Antebellum, and honestly, everybody that I've talked to that I trust in terms of movie reviews and whatnot, especially folks that I have who work out of New York and LA, who kind of have their finger on the pulse for most of these movies, have all kind of said the same thing. that Antebellum is kind of this empty shell of a social commentary film. It's more of a fan service movie than it is an actual educational piece to get people to understand a certain plight. And that kind of hurts to me, because it's like, we've only had real recognition of this subgenre for the last 4 years, maybe five. Why is it now that we're beginning to peter out? You know, and maybe I'm wrong. That's a big possibility, but this is where I want to bring the question to you guys. Do you guys feel that there is still room to move and breathe with the social thriller genre?
Possibly, because like the problem with social thrillers is sometimes they do strike just a bit too close to home, and like, you know, like sometimes you need a break, because like going back to like, you know, like not that long ago when like we were doing the whole Black Lives Matter protest, like for instance, that would have been a really bad time to probably release one of those movies, because like, at least for me, I couldn't have handled it then. And so you're kind of in like this thing where, since you're commentating on like things that are actually happening and things that like people go through, you can release a really good movie, but you can also do it at like some bad timing, and that can cause people to not want to see it. Because like, while I love Get Out, if it had released this year, like ignoring Corona, I don't know if I would have wanted to have seen it as much as I did then.
No, I agree.
Even though stuff was still going on, it didn't feel as, you know, in my face as it is right now.
What about you, Amy? How do you feel? Do you think the social thriller genre is beginning to kind of crest over the peak and make its way down the hill and on its way out? Or do you think there's still room to grow?
Until there's change, there's always room to grow. So right now, in consideration, is there an oversaturation of them in the visual medium? I don't know, because I don't genuinely seek out social commentary pieces like consistently. Exactly what Spencer said is that if Get Out had been released right now with everything happening, I don't know how I would feel about it, if it would create the same anticipation to want to see it. But staggering as it has been, so literally we were talking about books, we're talking about comic books, it's staggered in waves in such a space that it shows up every couple of years and then it backs off, and it essentially ebbs and it flows. Do I feel that every thriller that's going to be coming out in the next, 5 years is going to be a social commentary piece? I can't say. When it comes to Jordan Peele as a social commentary director, thriller director, do I have an expectation now that everything that he produces might lean that way? Not a very big one, but I've seen it in his work with The Twilight Zone, where, mind you, of the 10 episodes, not all of them had a social commentary piece. So he figured out ways to kind of ebb and flow with that as well. So I don't think it's petered out. But do I think that it's going to do exactly what it's done for the last couple of years, which is come up and go back? Yes. I find that this is, if suddenly everybody jumps on the social commentary bandwagon to say, oh, you know, my movie with Justin Bieber has social commentary, like,
I would watch that, because that sounds insane.
But
hey, CLM, Canadian Lives Matter. Okay.
Oh my God.
But I think that's exactly the point, that it's almost like, did you guys watch Kick-Ass?
Oh yeah.
One and two.
Yeah. Now in relation to Marvel movies, why did you watch Kick-Ass? Were you looking for another superhero movie? Was that within the genre that you were looking to?
Well, Kick-Ass came out before. Yeah. It was before the Marvel films, I believe.
Marvel started in 2008.
Yeah, but like, I feel like it was before their
2010.
Deep in the swing of stuff.
Because
at that time, you have 2008, But at that point in time, there was probably only two Marvel films out.
And I think it was Thor and Iron Man, which Steve's on our stuff will get mad at me on my podcast.
But and even then, I mean, you had the string of other ones through Fox and then through Sony, you know, with, you know, things like Blade and things like Fantastic Four and things like X-Men prior
Blade
to.
Blade was prior to 2008.
That's what I'm saying. Before.
Yeah, but even then, that I'm was a very setting, sparse. Setting, those, that genre at that sparsh. Time was very sparse.
Sparsh?
Sparse. Sparse? Sparse. Sparse.
That's what I'm like. There's an H at the end of that. And yes, I do think the idea, because, I mean, in all fairness, Kick-Ass is based on a comic book.
Oh, yeah. I'm not negating that fact.
So, real quick, at the time of Kick-Ass's release, there had only been two MCU films at that point.
And that's Thor Iron Man and Thor.
Right?
No, Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, and this is still at the point where they're with Paramount. They're still with Paramount at this point. They don't transition
before they get Cap to move back over.
No, this is before they get everybody to move over to Disney.
Yeah,
everybody at this point in time is with Paramount Pictures.
True,
all the way up until Captain America: The First Avenger.
Well, that was created by Paramount, wasn't it?
They were all created by Paramount.
I know you said up until, and it was after that.
Up until Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Thor. Captain America.
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm saying is at that time, before we had the big Marvel push where it was like every year we were getting a Marvel movie, the genre of the superhero movies was ebbing and flowing. You maybe got a Blade, you got one Blade, you might wait a little bit, three. Get Blade 2. I know.
And oh, sorry. Three.
I'm saying, I know. You get Spawn, it comes back off, you get, oh gosh, what was it? The guy in the purple suit? Not the Phantom. Yeah, it was the Phantom. You were getting him in waves.
Are you talking about Billy Zane? The Phantom.
Well, it's
well and then you have football. Then you have the football. Spirit. Then you have what was
the
Green Hornet? What was Alec Baldwin? Alec Baldwin was one. Oh, wow. He was the Vision. Or oh my gosh.
But so what I'm saying is with that genre, it didn't really suddenly jump. Like, it started out slow, was ebbing and flowing, until literally someone goes, hey, you like these movies? How about these movies? And it became an expectation that everything that Marvel puts out has to be better or top the previous one. That it
the
can.
Shadow.
There you go. Look at that. I just think of that Pinky and the Brain episode where he is the fog. And he just pulls down his face.
No.
Anyway, so I don't think right now that the social commentary thrillers as a movie genre has reached a peak of oversaturation. With that being said, also, we're in literally the middle of a pandemic where everybody has had to pull back on all of their movies because of a global pandemic.
Yeah, but in that same mindset, even though they've pulled back, it has given room for pause and reflect, especially on, I mean, if you take a look, how many people are going as nuts as they would have prior to with all the Marvel information? I mean, neither of you have mentioned any of, or had mentioned prior to showing, like the new Marvel news about, you know, Oscar Isaac and being cast as Moon Knight. But do you see, prior to, we would have all been stoked and talked about it. And the fact that we're giving that space for pause is creating that reflection of, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, I mean, I'll probably go see it, but, you know, I'm not as diehard as I was before with most
but
Marvel
also,
films.
Also, most people don't know who Moon Knight is.
But it's Oscar Isaac in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Does it really matter?
It was Michael Peña in Dora the Explorer.
He could play the Hulk's poop for all I care.
Michael Peña or Oscar Isaac?
They both can.
I would hope not, though.
You never know.
Well, I was waiting for you to bring up It Follows, Unfriended.
Well, those are
searching,
all
the other one with John Cho about him.
Searching.
Yeah, it was Searching. Yeah. I did it right.
Mind you, those are all great. I wanted to touch on one. I don't even know if I got a chance. Oh, I got a chance to touch on the two that were the most impactful, in my opinion, for me in the last few years. Yes, there's all these other ones. Searching is a great one. John Cho, done really well, actually, to be honest, the way it was filmed. There's quite a few. We had mentioned earlier Ginger Snaps. Ginger Snaps is one of those horror movies that is a complete, like, metaphor for a woman coming of age kind of thing. There's a lot of different kinds of stories and films that you could use, and mind you, we have had the opportunity of experiencing a lot of these movies for over the course of what, 40, 50, 60 years, 70 years, actually over 70 years in different avenues, whether if it was in horror, whether if it was in crime noir, whether if it was in whatever vehicle it carries in. Horror just seems to carry it with a little bit more ease, and we don't really see as many non-horror social thrillers nowadays. You take a look, probably the most recent one that probably has done remarkably well, that has been getting a lot more attention as of late, is that isn't a horror film, was Blindspotting. Blindspotting really changed the game when it came to these types of films. It was like Do the Right Thing for our modern age, plain and simple. Spike Lee was proud. But I think all in all,
what? Her?
Spike Lee?
No, I know. Her. The movie?
Yeah, but that wasn't a social, that wasn't really a social thriller. That was just a social commentary piece. I mean, consumerism is what it is, but we're looking at films that really create that edge and that
concern. So you're looking for the thriller mark on the end of the social commentary piece.
You know, you asked me if I was paying attention. Do I need to ask you if you're paying attention at the beginning?
I have a small child that's asking questions on my telephone, and I'm responding to that. So continue.
Huh.
Thriller. Horror. Things that I brought up.
A social thriller is a film genre using elements of suspense and horror to augment instances of oppression in society. Suspense and thriller.
So in other words, it's going to be like a comedy thriller that you're looking for that might have an opportunity to do that.
The thing is here, and this is kind of what I want to boil it down to. I don't know if, because I don't want it to just be like the quote unquote woke thing to do in creating a social thriller. Like that kind of bugs me, because that then means that there is a sense of bastardization for what social thrillers are.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you're going to have people doing it or creating them in their own mindsets because they want to be deemed acceptable in a community that is looking for people to share their ideals and their beliefs with. My concern is, so I'll be honest, I don't think we've hit a peak. I do believe we are beginning to see the holes in the progress, though. Mm-hmm. And the opportunities where we're seeing directors who are wanting to do it for the sake of doing it, but not really hitting the mark per se. And mind you, that's not to say that there aren't redeemable qualities to certain films like that are out there. There's not redeemable instances, but to say that this genre is still very much in its reawakening, almost like Renaissance age, similar with how Disney faced their Renaissance age during the late 80s, early 90s. This is the Renaissance era of social thrillers, of woke cinema, however you want to call it. And my fear is that it's not ripped out of the hands of the people who are nurturing it so that they can claim they had a hand in building it. And that's my biggest concern. I will forever be the optimist, the person who hopes and when it comes to movies, don't give me that look. When it comes to movies,
and Spencer's like listening. He's like, yeah, you an optimist.
Optimist. You know what? So where's the mute button? Let me just find the mute button right here.
Oppression. Hello. Yeah,
thank you.
I'm
gonna oppress black voices during this
and
year.
And female voices.
She's not black.
Yeah. That part's true. I checked my hair.
Because I said I was going to mute her.
He said black voices.
I thought
voices.
You were muting both of us.
Yeah.
I kind of need you to close out the episode with me, so.
Oh, so he doesn't need me. look at that. I'm being oppressed by the patriarchy. Again.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. On this podcast, Eddie, really?
That's what you get, homie.
So make sure to say goodbye to Amy, as she will not be returning. No, I just, my biggest thing is I want to make sure, obviously, as the Halloween season, and as we wrap this whole thing up, as the Halloween season comes to a close, to recognize that, yes, there are a lot of things happening right now in the world, and there are a lot of opportunities to share what you believe in an opportunity where you don't have to directly say it to people sometimes. Because let's be honest, not everybody's comfortable with saying, hey, this is what I stand for, this is what I believe. But if you sit here and say, hey, you know what, you should check out this movie because this really is an educational movie, it's really great, awesome acting, and you know, it talks about some really important issues. Or you should check out that movie because it talks about that, this and that and the other. This type of cinema has created an opportunity to bridge gaps for conversations to happen that some people are just not capable of having those, whether if it's through stress or nerves or unable to put into words exactly what it is they believe or feel. This is a clear opportunity to say, hey, this movie, yeah, this is a good movie. And I think that's one of the things, among other things, that this type of cinema does for fans, this type of cinema does for moviegoers. And to be honest, it's one that, you know, I have yet to find a reason why we should not celebrate these types of movies, especially when it comes to the time where, like Spencer put, that we're kind of at a peak of chaos and subversion and government chaos and everything else. So let it be said that if there's ever an opportunity for a message to be spoken across the world, let it be in movies. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter and Instagram page at filmlosophy101. Also, you can check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. We got over 200 episodes. Check us out. Follow us there. Also on streaming platforms, everywhere else. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. If you're listening to this prior to or on Halloween, we hope that you have a great evening. You have a great time. Celebrate safely, cleanly. Sanitize everything.
Wear a mask.
And just try to have fun. And be safe as well. You know, there's a lot of things going on in the world, and the last thing we need is another spike due to,
yeah.
So, yeah, have fun, be safe, and know that we here at the Filmlosophers are wishing you a happy and wonderful Halloween. Before we close out, any last thoughts, Spence, on the movies or anything?
No. This is the end sequence. This is past that time I'm for
just,
that question.
I'm just throwing things your way. Just checking.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Okay. Amy, where can people find you and where can people see you?
Well, hopefully they don't see me much because I try to avoid that.
Oh, you guys don't use Twitch anymore. That's right.
We don't, so you can't see me like... Oh. Well, there's I'm one-shotting all right, on just, a different thing. Anyway, you can find the Capeless Crusaders at thecapelesscrusaders.com. Your hub, your home away from home for all things comic-y, book-y, creator-y, stuff like that. That's our sweet, sweet jam. We actually just had our episode drop this last Monday. And we also have a bonus Patreon episode that went out, which you got to pay some money to get to. But Senor Eduardo over yonder actually guested for a long talk about... Halloween horror and the films that they love. Like, he had people basically nerding out. It was great, apparently, from what I heard. I wasn't on the episode. Anyway, yeah, you can find me there, and I'm always IJNewRobot at the varying social media platforms, sadly including TikTok, but I can't do anything, so yeah.
You gotta learn how to floss and do it.
Oh, heck no, techno. Homer don't play like that. Nope.
Well, like we said, have a great and wonderful Halloween. Have fun, be safe, and know that from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Amy.
Class dismissed.